They float and swarm, harass and irritate, and they can even take down a chicken or a turkey. The gnats are back. This hour, we'll talk about early summer pests, gnats, ticks, and mosquitoes. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day. Iowa State University Extension entomologist Donald Lewis is here. We'll talk about the gnats and ticks that are here and the mosquitoes to come. Iowa State University Extension horticulturist Richard Giron will also be here, and he and Donald will answer your questions about plants and insects. You can send your questions to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Join our conversation after the news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day today, and while we enjoy these beautiful early days of summer, we all have to share our outdoor spaces with companions that we don't always enjoy. We're going to start the hour today by talking about gnats, ticks, and mosquitoes. Iowa State University Extension entomologist Donald Lewis is here. Hello, Donald.
Hello, Charity. Glad to be here.
Well, and I think today, starting the hour off with gnats really makes the show fit its title better than anything else. This is the talk of Iowa right now. I haven't run into anybody who doesn't want to talk about gnats lately. And Iowa City is inundated with a horrible gnat infestation for the second year in a row. But gnats are getting to be far more widespread around the state, right?
Well, we think so. But there's nobody out there doing a census of gnats. And so we're relying more on the calls, the emails, the questions that we get. Of course, you have to start the conversation about gnats with realizing when someone uses the word gnat, they're using a term that is about 2 miles wide.
Right. It means any small insect that's annoying me.
Especially, yes, especially annoying.
Right.
And to say this insect is a gnat is like saying you were passed on the highway by a vehicle. You don't know if they're talking about a Pinto or a Peterbilt. So gnat means a lot of different things to different people. But one of the fundamental questions when trying to figure out what people are talking about is you ask, do they bother you or do they bite you? And what we're hearing is in the eastern half of Iowa, more so than in the rest of the state, the gnats are biting. And that pins it down pretty quickly to what we're talking about. Another name for this would be buffalo gnat. Sometimes it's called the turkey gnat. What entomologists frequently call this one is black fly.
All right, so they're a little bit larger than what we might think of as our stereotypical gnat?
The stereotypical gnat is probably the fruit fly that is around your cracked tomatoes in the fall. It's around your overripe melons. It's the one that falls into your red wine at the picnic. The typical fruit fly is smaller than what these black flies are. So you're right. This is not as big as a house fly. It's not as small as a fruit fly. It's about halfway in between.
All right. And they bite you and they create these big red lumps.
The females are blood feeders and they feed on a wide variety of birds and other animals. And as the female is feeding, she's injecting a saliva that probably contains some anticoagulants and some other things to help her digest this high-protein food that she has taken in for the purpose of creating more eggs. It's the saliva that creates the reaction in people, in addition to just the irritation of the cut that she has made with her mouth parts to get to your blood. But that saliva then creates a reaction that varies with the individual. Some of us get a small itchy spot. Some people get a red itchy spot. Some people swell tremendously because of this reaction.
And is it only the females that are irritating us?
In this particular species, yes. It's only the females that feed on blood. And they feed on blood because they need a protein food source to create eggs. Males don't need that protein food source, and so they're off feeding on flower nectar and probably just hanging out without doing much feeding. Yes, in both mosquitoes and in black flies, it's the female that bites.
And about how long would these buffalo gnats hang around?
It's a springtime, limited time problem. They have one generation per year. So we are seeing the offspring of gnats that were here last spring. They have spent the intervening time as larvae in the river attached to rocks, and they only have this one generation. So there's this limited period of maybe 4 weeks where it's really bad, and then it starts to taper off. So it is a limited time event, but during that time, it can be a terrible annoyance to people who live near rivers, people who fish or recreate near rivers, and poultry operations that are nearby as well.
Right. I mentioned in the billboard that these buffalo gnats can take down a chicken or a turkey or many chickens or turkeys, other kinds of poultry. And what happens? What are they doing?
A couple of different things happen when the gnats are biting. Chickens will try to escape the biting by grouping up and piling on, and the chickens at the bottom of the pile can get trampled and suffocated by the chickens that are still jumping on top of them trying to escape the gnats. For turkeys, there's not quite that same behavior, and it's the irritation, the blood loss, and the reaction to the saliva that can cause the birds to be sick enough to die.
And chicks are particularly vulnerable, aren't they?
Just like us, when you're younger, when you have suppressed immune systems, when your defenses aren't completely developed, you're more susceptible. So, yes, it can be a problem for chicks and all the way up to older hens and turkeys as well.
Now, last spring, the talk of Iowa City was the gnats. And I remembered you saying that about 3 or 4 weeks we'll get through this. And it seemed to me last year, and this is my anecdotal evidence, but that we got through one kind of gnat. And as that one was dissipating, we had an influx of another kind of gnat. Is that possible?
Oh, sure. And when that gnat goes, you can get any one of the other 2,000 different species of gnats. So last year and through eastern Iowa, but it was more like 2010 in the center part of the state, we had a bunch of cool, wet weather early in the year that was followed by a rapid warm-up, and we had an influx of what we call fungus gnats. These are harmless. They don't bite. They don't. They can't sting. They're more of the annoyance, and that's what we talk about when people ask us what to do about the gnats. That type of gnat is always around. You can raise them in your potted house plants if you overwater excessively, and they're always around, but in some years it just seems like the weather conditions conspire to produce a lot of larvae in wet soil areas, and then when the temperatures warm up, they all emerge at once, and we have these huge outbreaks or these swarms of gnats. Of course, then in the summer, you'll see these gnats down by the river that are floating in these little clouds. So there's lots of different species that come at different times.
All right. Well, let's move on from gnats. And of course, you will be taking questions throughout the hour if people have questions about gnats. But let's talk about ticks next, because there's something else that comes out in the early summer. And I know that in the past, you have told me that tick populations are wildly variable. Well, I tell you, I'm living in a nest of ticks this year. We've encountered so many. Have you been hearing from a lot of people who are saying they're encountering a lot of ticks this year?
Yes. And again, there is no census to document how many ticks are there. Is it really worse? Or is it just that some people are noticing more, and so they're the ones who are calling, while other people are noticing fewer and not bothering to call? But ticks are one that it doesn't take very many to irritate people. And so a tick is often one too many. And when you get up to a few, it really starts to annoy you. And so it seems like it's a really terrible year for somebody every year.
Right.
So every year we hear two questions. Number one, why are there so many ticks? And that'll be followed by a phone call that says, I haven't had a tick this year. Where did they go? So widely variable or wildly variable is the way we describe tick populations. And it has so much to do with the opportunity of where you walked and where the ticks were waiting, whether or not you think it's a problem or not.
I've been in all the right places this year, I
guess.
And I was surprised in reading a little bit about ticks that they are not insects. They're arachnids.
That's right. Ticks are more closely related to spiders. Ticks in their adult stage have 8 legs, not the 6 legs that we associate with insects. Ticks only have 2 body parts, and everybody learned in grade school that insects have 3 body parts, the head, the thorax, and the abdomen. In ticks and spiders and in mites, the other close relative in that group, there are only 2 body parts. In the adult stage, there are 8 legs.
And with ticks, as you mentioned, I mean, sometimes it's one tick and people totally freak out. So when you find ticks crawling on you or your kids or your pets, when do you need to be concerned?
If one is crawling, it's not a problem. And the typical scenario is you walk through an area where a tick was waiting and they crawl to the top of grass blades and they wave their legs in the air. And as you walk by, they latch onto you and there'll be a period of crawling around while the tick is looking for a place to attach. So even though all ticks come from the ground, all ticks come from the tall shrubbery, the tall grasses and so forth, those moist, humid areas, they will crawl around on us until they find a place of concealment. And for us, the naked ape, the best place of concealment is in our hair. And so we frequently find ticks on the nape of the neck because they have climbed the entire length of your body and decided, ooh, this is a protected place. I'll embed here. And they begin inserting their mouth part into your skin. If they're crawling, nothing has happened. They haven't bitten you. It's not a problem. If they are attached but flat, it's no big deal. You just pull them off. If they are attached and engorged, that is fully swollen up because they have been feeding on your blood for the last 12 to 24 hours, you still pull them off. But at that point, you probably use a little antiseptic and you begin to watch for further symptoms and consult your medical professional. If the engorged tick you pulled off turns out to be the black-legged tick, which is the only one that carries a significant disease risk here in the state.
And I'm pretty good at identifying ticks when they're not engorged. They're harder to identify for me when they are engorged. How do you know it's that tick?
One of your ways is to send it to us here at Iowa State University, and you can use your local county extension office for this, or you can go online and look up Iowa Tick Surveillance. You can mail those ticks directly to Iowa State University in a Ziploc bag, and you'll get a message back telling you what kind of tick it is. So that's still a free service here from Iowa State University that will help you identify ticks if you're not certain. The size is one of the good indications of what kind of tick it is. If it engorges and it's as big as a small grape, well, that was an American dog tick and not the problem. But if it's still a small tick, even though it's engorged, and especially if you feel like there's a little bit of orange coloration to it, then we might be thinking black-legged tick, and that one would be one that we would send in for confirmation.
All right. And we haven't talked about mosquitoes, but mosquitoes are really yet to come.
They're yet to come, but the situation is good. We've got standing water. Today, in the last couple of days, we've had great rainfalls to fill the puddles, and now we have 80-degree temperatures. Mosquitoes will be next.
All right, we're setting the stage. Perfect mosquito weather.
I'm so pleased.
All right, we're going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. Iowa State University Extension entomologist Donald Lewis is here. Iowa State University Extension horticulturist Richard Giron will be joining us in just a moment. And you can join the conversation with your questions. 866-780-9100. 866-780-9100. Tweet us at IPR Talk or send email. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day today, and with me, Iowa State University Extension entomologist Donald Lewis, and also here now, Iowa State University Extension horticulturist Richard Giron. Good morning, Richard.
Good morning.
Thank you so much for being here today, and you can join the conversation with your questions as well about plants or insects or tiny arachnids. Give us a call at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And we'll start with RJ in Urbandale. Hi, RJ.
Hi. Hey, I got an issue with out here at the picnic table. There's all kinds of little teeny red bugs with a bunch of legs on them. They're like a 16th of an inch by maybe a quarter of an inch long. Oval shaped.
Oh. Really? A quarter of an inch long?
I don't know. They might not even be that big. I haven't had a chance to measure them.
Okay. Because a couple of different possibilities have jumped into my mind. When you first started talking about small red bugs with lots of legs, my mind went to clover mite. And clover mite lives in the lawn. It feeds on weeds and grasses but causes no problem.
Good.
But in the spring, they get a wanderlust, and they'll just take off, and they'll climb and crawl across everything. You'll see them on the sidewalk, on the picnic table, on the house. Occasionally they'll get in through your windows and you'll find them on your kitchen counter. They're fairly reddish brown and they have 8 legs and the front pair of legs are very long. They're also down there closer to a 32nd of an inch rather than a quarter of an inch.
I tell you, all I know is they're everywhere, and they're just, it's hard to make. I was trying to come up, I thought it may be a 16th inch, but yeah, I was concerned. I have a bump on my finger, and I thought maybe there was something that bit me, and I didn't know. I was really concerned.
Now, we can rule that one out. Clover mites feed on plants, and they only feed on plants. They don't bite. They can't sting. Now, the other bright red insect that people should be finding soon is the box elder bug. And that one is football-shaped, really bright red, exist in clusters, but they only have 6 legs. So you may need a magnifying glass here to count the number of legs to figure it out, but those are the two bright red things I would expect to see in number at this time of year.
And box elder bugs don't bite either.
And they can't bite. They are also plant feeders.
All right, RJ, thanks a lot for your call. And Donald, this one's maybe out of your area of expertise, but we'll give it a shot. Chris is on the line in Clayton County. Hi, Chris.
Hi, Charity.
Hi, what's your question?
I've got a small flock of chickens, and we've been experiencing a lot of the gnats, just like a lot of people in Iowa. And I'm wondering what I can do to protect my chickens. I've noticed they're pecking and, you know, ruffling their feathers, trying to protect themselves. I don't know if there's anything I can do to protect them from those gnats.
This is a question for your veterinarian. There are sprays that can be used, but the problem is, the black flies are not impressed with our chemical deterrents. They just keep coming. You might kill the ones that are there, but there's more coming from the river. They're also never impressed with our repellents. We have good repellents that will keep mosquitoes from biting you because it interferes with the mosquito's ability to detect you as a food source. The black flies and the ticks aren't as impressed by repellents. I would contact your local veterinarian and see what they have for black fly control on chickens and follow the veterinarian's advice very carefully.
And Chris, just from one chicken owner to another, one thing that I've read recently is that if your chickens have an area of deep shade, they can sometimes get away from the gnats. And so my chickens they're completely free range except at night, and they are non-existent during the day because they're all hiding under bushes or in the barn. And the recommendation, if you don't have a space like that, was to put some boards, lean some boards up against a building or something like that where they can go in and hide, and they will probably lie very low for a while.
The black flies are day feeders. The buffalo gnat, they only feed during the day, and by sundown, they stop biting. So the shade does make good sense, and at night, something else will come out to bite, but it won't be these.
Right. Well, and hopefully the chickens will be in bed by then. Chris, thanks for your call. Next up, we have Sharon and Martel. Hi, Sharon.
Hello.
Hi. What's your question?
We live on a farm in eastern Iowa, and we are having a wedding on our property the end of June, and know that there is any number of questions as far as which insects might be out at that time and there to cause us problems. But what I'm wondering is if there is a fairly general environmentally safe type of spray for children and adults that could be put out on the property before the event that might discourage either, I hope gnats are gone, but mosquitoes or some of the other things that might be out, just to make our event more pleasant.
A very common question, and by the end of June, yes, it will just probably be the mosquitoes that will be the biggest concern. So what we hope for is a light breeze that day. Mosquitoes are less likely to find us in the breeze than they are on a very calm day. There are lots of things that people try for which we have no basis for recommending, and that would be things like citronella candles aren't going to cover a large area. There are granules you sprinkle on the lawn that make your yard smell like mothballs. They smell like your grandmother's closet. I don't think that's going to do much for you either. So one option is to spray the edges of the lawn. You don't need to spray the grass, but the flower beds, the shrubs, the edges, the outer perimeter can be sprayed the day before with an insecticide that will kill the mosquitoes that are there, and it'll give you about 24 hours worth of protection from mosquitoes or a reduction in population. And you can do that with some common garden insecticides. One of them that we've used for a long time is malathion, is still available for that. Not necessarily the best smelling alternative, so I might go to one of the other garden insecticides that's for shrubs and flowers and vegetables and can be sprayed around the area. You can also hire an exterminator to come make this treatment for you. The day before, make that treatment. Then finally, my suggestion for a June wedding is to have a nice little basket, line it with one of the napkins that matches the color scheme of the wedding, and put foil packets of repellent wipes in there. You know, not cans of repellent, but you can get these little foil packets that contain repellent, sort of like a wet wipe sort of a thing. And people can pick that up and dab that gently on themselves as they arrive if the mosquitoes are going to bother them. But those are really the suggestions. Hope for wind, spray the day before, or put out repellent for the guests.
All right, Sharon, thank you so much for your call. I know people, Donald, who've done dry ice to try to change the makeup of the air to discourage mosquitoes. You sound skeptical.
I'm pretty skeptical of that. There are expensive gadgets. Some of them claim to be mosquito magnets, and they will contain dry ice or a carbon dioxide source to try to make something that's more attractive to mosquitoes off to the side than you are. And while you can catch a lot of mosquitoes that way, the chances of eliminating a mosquito population are pretty slim. So the best we can hope is that we beat it down a little bit for a little while, because if weather conditions persist the way they are, the mosquitoes will continue to reproduce and continue to move into the area.
All right. You are listening to Horticulture Day on Talk of Iowa. Let's do some plant questions. What do you say, Richard?
Okay.
All right. This is from Aaron. I have two very large Annabelle hydrangea plants that I absolutely love, but they're starting to take over the other plants in my garden. Can these be divided and replanted, and when's the best time of year to do that?
Dividing basically is difficult. It's difficult to divide a woody plant. As far as perennials, easy, but when you have a woody plant, it's very hard to divide that. So I would prune it back if necessary, but dividing it probably is not very feasible.
Although with your shovel, you can chop off the edges, and it's a lot of work to get down through that root mass. But to keep them from spreading, you just keep digging a moat around them.
What you could do if you really wanted to try to do that would be to go out basically in early April, as soon as the ground thaws out, and go ahead and dig up the plant, and then basically divide it with like a shovel or a spade.
Or an axe.
And put it back in the ground.
All right. Next, let's go to Robin in Iowa City at 866-780-9100. Hi, Robin.
Hi, good morning.
Hi, what's your question?
So I've actually got a couple questions. We've got this weird sort of weed grass that's growing in our lawn kind of around the periphery, like by the driveway and the sidewalks, that almost grows out in vines. What is it and how do we kill it?
Well, I'm not sure exactly what it is. It's not really a grass then, right? It's more of a broadleaf plant?
Yeah, it's got kind of thicker type leaves. I mean, it almost looks like a grass, but in the fall it leaves like these really nasty big brown patches. Okay. And in the summer it's a lot darker green than the rest of our yard.
I think we're going to need some photos. If you have a digital
Sorry
camera,
about that.
That's okay. If you have a digital camera, take some nice close-ups of the plant and send those to Hortline, Hortline, at iastate.edu.
Aren't you guessing it's going to be knotweed, or is it going to be spurge that comes later in the year?
It's hard to say. Knotweed is a very common weed. We typically see that in areas where the grass has died out due to compaction or some other problem.
Frequently along the sidewalk.
Right. It's a very dark color green. Comes up very early in the spring. and typically dies basically in the fall with that first hard freeze. But it's a very common weed. It's a broadleaf plant, and broadleaf herbicides will control that if you apply a broadleaf herbicide.
Okay. And my next question is, we have a raised flower bed in front that now gets full sun due to the fact that our ash tree died. What would be a good plant that we could put there, kind of like a hosta that's very low maintenance but looks pretty?
Well, one possibility would be daylilies. And if you go that route, I would select one of the repeat blooming daylilies, like Pardon Me, Happy Returns, Stella de Aura, because they will bloom for basically 10 to 12 weeks beginning in late spring, which is great. You have color for a long period of time. And daylilies are very low maintenance.
And when do they usually get planted?
If they're in containers, you can plant them right now. No problem.
All right. Thank you so much.
Yep, Robin, thank you so much for your call. And we have a couple of lines open for your questions at 866-780-9100. Tweet us at IPR Talk or send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Kathy posted this question on Facebook. Some of my irises haven't bloomed since the first year I planted them. They've multiplied nicely, but no new blooms. Any ideas?
Well, make sure they get plenty of sun. They do need at least 6 hours of direct sun per day. If they don't get that, they may not bloom. Typically what happens is after several years, they get overcrowded. And when they're overcrowded, they don't bloom. So that usually occurs after maybe 4 or 5 years. They can divide them. It might be a good idea if they seem to be crowded. And I would do that in June or July.
All right. Let's go back to the phones. This is Jennifer in Fairfield. Hi, Jennifer.
Hi.
Hi, what's your question?
Yes, it's about my aloe vera plant. I have a friend who has been raising like 10 aloe veras, and I planted one of them in my garden about 5 weeks ago. And the plant was doing great for a few weeks, and then it started looking really sick. And upon closer examination, there's very small red bugs crawling all over it. I think those would be red mites.
Mm-hmm.
And so about the outer leaves, about half of the leaves, which are the outer leaves, are yellow and dying. And so my question is, would this be red mites or something else? And secondly, if it's red mites, I've read that they're very hard to get rid of. And my problem is that the aloe, even though it's planted by itself, is right next to a organic raised bed that I've been prepping. Mm-hmm. Has a cover crop on it right now, and so I want to try to fight the red mites through non-chemical means.
Yeah. Boy, we don't get a lot of questions about aloe pests, but
yeah.
Red mites in the lawn at this time of the year reminds me again of one of the earlier callers who talked about clover mites, which feed on grasses and weeds, but usually aren't much of a problem, but they just wander through. They're crawling through, and you'll find them on every place you look if you look hard enough, long enough. I doubt that that's the problem. I'm forming an opinion, but really can't substantiate it yet, that there was an environmental, a nutrient, a light. There's some other combination of factors that may be more detrimental to the plant than these mites. But let me tell you what you can do. You can spray them with insecticidal soap. This is a detergent that you buy at the garden center. You mix it with water. You spray it on. It's an organic alternative. It only kills what it hits. So you're not going to spray it on and eliminate all the spider mites that might be around the area. But they would be. It would kill the ones that are on the plant at the time you treat it. Red mite is not really common in the lawn and garden the way it is on apple trees. What we usually have in the garden is called the two-spotted spider mite, and it's not red. It's a greenish-yellow kind of a color. So I don't think you've got a major mite problem. What about environmental conditions for aloe in the garden, Richard?
Basically, full sun, at least 6 hours of direct sun per day, and a well-drained soil, basically.
Yeah. All right. Jennifer, thank you so much for your call. And Carol's on the line next in Des Moines. Hi, Carol.
Good morning.
What's your question?
I have three small lilac bushes that have bloomed, and I'd like to trim them up and shape them. Can I just take my electric trimmer and buzz them, or do I have to be pretty careful with how I shape them. I'd like to kind of get them into a shape that is consistent so they're all about the same size.
Yeah, I would prefer using a hand shears or pruning shears so you don't have the barber cut type appearance to the plant where you prune back specific branches at specific points. So I'd prefer to do that with a pruning shears and try to maintain kind of a normal shape to the plant if you can.
All right.
And as far as timing, try to do that sometime in the next week or two.
Okay, Carol, thank you so much for your call. And we'll go to the break with this comment from Dan. I was assured this past winter that the severe cold and duration of the harsh winter would mean there would be fewer bugs this summer. Clearly, I was misinformed. Should I complain to the meteorologists, entomologists, or mass media in general? And Donald, you told us that that was just a theory that we all wanted to buy into. So
it's a myth. It's wishful thinking to believe that the insects are affected by winter the way we are. We suffered through it, so we hope they did too. Obviously, they did quite well in that running water. The black flies did quite well. The mosquitoes are going to do quite well when the weather conditions return to what they should be. So it was a myth. It was a lie then. It's a lie now. We're sorry you bought it.
All right. And you, this is your opportunity to say, I told you so.
You're exactly.
All right. Iowa State University Extension entomologist Donald Lewis, Iowa State University Extension horticulturist Richard Giron, they are here to answer your questions. And you can join us at 866-780-9100. Tweet us at IPR Talk or send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day today, and with me, Iowa State University Extension horticulturist Richard Giron and Iowa State University Extension entomologist Donald Lewis. They are here to answer your questions about plants or insects. You can call us at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Here's an email from Bethany in Iowa City. I've noticed many millipedes in my garden this year. They're about 1.5 inches long and black with yellow stripes. What do you know about them, and are they something I should be concerned about?
Huh, a Hawkeye-colored millipede.
How, in Iowa City.
How convenient. Well, millipedes have four legs on each ring of the body, and that's how we tell them from centipedes. Millipedes are beneficial because they feed on decaying organic matter, and with the moisture we've had this spring and with good soil, with mulch, with lots of grass clippings and other organic debris around, we can raise pretty large populations of millipedes. But as long as the millipedes stay outside, they're beneficial. They're helping us. They're recyclers breaking down organic matter, and we don't need to worry about them. They don't feed on crops. They don't feed on plants. They don't bite. They can't sting. So they're beneficial, and we can leave them alone. That color doesn't describe our regular millipede, but there are lots of them out there, so that could be the one that she has. Now, if they're centipedes, they only have two legs per body segment. And the legs are much longer. The legs are much more obvious. Centipedes outdoors are also beneficial because they're feeding on other arthropods, small mites, small insects, small spiders, and so forth. So outdoors, both millipedes and centipedes are beneficial. We don't need to kill or control either one of them.
All right. Here's another garden insect question. This is from Kara. I have an insect question. I have two raised 4x8 beds with vegetable plants in them. I've noticed small black ants in the beds and anthills adjacent to the beds. Also, my cauliflower and tomatillo plants have begun to have small holes in the leaves. Are the ants the culprit? I was going to try diatomaceous earth to get rid of them, but if they're possibly a garden helper, I don't want to kill them.
Ants are almost always beneficial outdoors. Ant mounds in the lawn can be annoying, and if the ants choose to nest and burrow and tunnel right next to your young transplants, occasionally the soil will dry out from the tunneling action, and you can lose a plant to desiccation because there's no soil in contact with the roots. Aside from those two problems, ants are beneficial because of the aeration, the recycling, the scavenging that they're doing. ants are not plant feeders. They're not feeding on the fresh leaves. So the damage to the plant foliage is not caused by the ants. We would like to tolerate, leave the ants alone for the benefit that they provide. Occasionally there's an ant mound in a place we don't like it, so we might treat that individual ant mound. But we need to find another culprit for holes in the leaves. And it could be anything from hail to weather conditions to maybe flea beetles or something else that's hard to see.
All right, let's get back to the phones. John is on the line in Lockridge. Hi, John.
Hi, how you doing?
Good. What's your question?
Thanks for taking my call. Hey, I've got this, for lack of a better term, it's a snowball bush.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I'm talking about? And then I've got some hydrangea bushes. And, boy, they've been big and healthy and doing real well. And we got... well, in this one hydrangea in particular, there was a grapevine, a wild grape that grew up through it.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And it did that on the snowball bush, too. And we thought, it's probably not going to hurt anything, you know, provide habitat for the birds and that. Well, it killed off a lot of the bushes.
Well, maybe there might be some winter kill in there. We had a very, very cold winter, the coldest winter in 35 years. And so there may be some winter dieback in there, too. So,
Do these grapevines, are they known for being, you know, damaging to them? I didn't think they would be.
Well, they can damage a plant in that they are very fast growers. And so if they grow and cover the canopy of the shrub or plant...
Kind of smother it?
Well, they deprive it of sunlight, and that's not a good thing. So... you typically don't want it covering your plant if you can avoid it.
Uh-huh. So this is, you think you're kind of leaning towards a winter kill then?
I think that's probably a big factor in it, yes, because we have seen dieback on a number of trees and shrubs, including some of the hydrangeas.
All right. Does he need to think about pruning that grapevine back?
I would consider removing it, and you can do that either by digging it up or cutting it off near the ground and applying Roundup to the cut surface.
All right, John, thanks a lot for your call. Next, Lori in Cedar Rapids. Hi, Lori.
Hello. I was just thinking that I had about $100 worth of hydrangea that I planted last fall, and I just had hay around it because with mowing, it's a problem in the summer, all the wood chips. Mm-hmm. But I was wondering if that would have been a better option to protect new plants. Wasn't sure what you thought about that.
Straw versus wood chips?
Right. But the wood chips have provided more coverage, better protection for new plants?
No, I really don't think so. And the mulch basically helps to control weeds. It conserves moisture, that type of thing. It really doesn't protect it much against the cold. So it doesn't provide much in the way of winter protection. So I think wood chips are more attractive, but either one is fine.
Okay. My husband had our lawn service put on some more grub protection. We did it a couple of years ago. Is that too often? I know it could kill off your worms and things like that.
Actually, the insecticides that are available today are no longer toxic to earthworms. That was not true 20 years ago, that the insecticides we used for grub control back then were toxic to earthworms. Those have all been taken off the market. The modern insecticides like Merit and Arena and Acilaprin and so forth, all of those are tested against earthworms, and they're not sold if they're toxic to earthworms. So you don't have to worry about the earthworms from that. Grubs come every year, and it's an annual life cycle. So the beetles lay their eggs in June and July. We have grubs in August and September when the damage occurs, and then next year there'll be another crop. So if you are adverse to any risk of white grubs, you do need to apply the treatment every year. Most of us aren't that worried about white grubs. Occasionally we have a few, but we can live with that by repairing the damage they do, and those are your options. So a golf course that can take has no tolerance for white grubs would apply every year. Those of us in the home lawn situation can cut back and not do that.
All right. Thanks a lot for your call, Lori. And next up, let's go to Kate in Tiffin. Hi, Kate.
Hi.
What's your question?
I have a new house and a new subdivision with a tree
and it is a maple, and it was growing last fall, and it's not growing now. There's no leaves on it at all.
Right.
So I was wondering, did it probably kill, winter kill, or do you think it was installed improperly?
Well, I would say that the cold winter was a major factor. When you plant a tree, that first winter is always going to be the toughest. And unfortunately, this past winter was the coldest winter in 25 years. So I'm assuming that the cold was the primary factor.
Okay. All right. Well, I will replant that instead of asking my contractor to replant it then.
Okay. And what kind of tree was it, by the way? Do you know?
It was a maple. I'm not sure which one.
Okay. We have been seeing quite a few cases of these hybrid maples, these red maple, silver maple hybrids, specifically like Autumn Blaze. We have seen quite a few cases of those trees, younger trees, not surviving the winter very well. And that's a concern because they're widely planted. So I would look at some other tree, possibly maybe an oak, maybe a linden, possibly a sugar maple, and try to get that in the ground as soon as you can if you're going to plant this year.
Okay, I will. Thank you.
All right, Kate, thank you very much for your call. Next up, Dean in Des Moines. Hi, Dean.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I live in a retirement home, and we have Scotchwright Park in Des Moines. We just put in 42 raised beds for older gardeners with 19 inches tall with seats on the side. And we filled them with about two-thirds black dirt, about one-third compost from the Des Moines compost operation. And my question is about shade. One corner of this area gets about 7 hours of sun a day, direct sunlight, and the other corner gets full sunlight. I need to advise people about what they can plant in the where you only have 7 hours of direct sun.
Well, 7 hours of direct sun actually is fine for plants that like full sun. They don't need to have sun from sunrise to sunset. So if you have things like, for example, vegetables, tomatoes, peppers, cucumbers, they should be fine. If you have flowers, things like geraniums, petunias, marigolds, they should be fine. So actually, 6 hours is that cutoff point. So you should be able to grow anything that likes full sun.
All right. Thanks a lot for your call, Dean. Good to have options. Tom is on the line next in Indianola. Hi, Tom.
Hi, Tom.
Hi, how you doing?
Good. What's your question?
My house backs to a bike trail that used to be a railroad track. And now it's overrun with nettles. I'm sorry, you're breaking up. Can you?
Okay, so I guess he's gone.
Nettle control, though.
Right, nettles. I think he was also wanting to ask about poison ivy and other plants that are less desirable and if there's anything he could do on a bike trail for those things.
Well, as far as control, you have basically two options. One is digging, and you can definitely dig those up. Otherwise, it'd be a herbicide like Roundup where you're very selective in the application.
What about mowing them every week? Would that get rid of nettles?
It would, I think, eventually cause them to decline, maybe eventually die. The same thing with poison ivy. If you have them try to invade the yard, they typically die out if they're repeatedly mowed.
All right. Next, let's go to Roy in Ames. Hi, Roy.
Yes.
What's your question?
We got a perennial flower bed, and our problem is trying to keep weeds out of it, and especially quack grass and foxtail and that type of thing. And I've wondered any good way to do that.
Well, there are ways to do that. Not an easy way, though, especially something like quack grass. Quack grass is a perennial grass, and it spreads very aggressively underground via these underground stems or rhizomes. And with something like quack grass, you have to physically destroy that entire system of rhizomes in the ground, all of them. Because if you leave certain portions, they will resprout and grow again. So you have to destroy the whole system.
Yeah.
So basically something like quack grass requires persistence and patience. You can dig it up and very carefully try to remove all those plant parts you find in the soil. That takes patience. You're probably not going to get them all, so you have to come back again when they resprout and keep on doing that maybe over 3 or 4 months. The other option would be to use something like Roundup, but again, you're going to have to do this repeatedly over 3 or 4 months. So it is going to take patience and persistence. Once you get rid of it, then I would use a mulch, something like wood chips, shredded bark, something like that. But you really have to get rid of them first because they can push their way up through a mulch. The mulch will not kill them. So you have to get rid of things like quackgrass beforehand.
All right. Thanks a lot for your call. And this is an email from Thomas in Iowa City. We planted a plum tree on a shallow slope next to our driveway in our alley a few years ago. The area was a bit sloped, so we planted it at the top of the slope, and I've been piling leaves and compost on the short side to try to level the area. We had the tree tethered to some T-posts, and I finally got around to removing them that last weekend, only to find that the tree the next morning was leaning dramatically to the side. The tree is about as thick around as my wrist. Why can't the tree stand up on its own, and is there anything I can do about it?
Boy, you're probably going to have to support it for the life of the tree. As it gets bigger, that's going to become more problematic because if you have a windstorm, there's going to be so much pressure put on it that it may just basically fall over. So apparently it just hasn't developed a good root system, and it can't stand up by itself. So it's probably going to have to be supported. Now, plum trees tend to be short-lived anyway, so you're going to have to get some really sturdy supports and basically tie it up.
All right. Next, Joyce in Iowa City. Hi, Joyce.
Hi.
What's your question?
Well, we have had a lot of winter kill this year. We lost 4 of our mums, and we had 5 rows of Sharon in the back of our yard facing west. One looks beautiful. It's leafed out and real green, and there's no sign of life on the other 4. And we're just wondering why one could survive and the others couldn't.
Well,
should we just pull them up and replant? Or?
Well, the Rosa Sharon is marginally hardy, especially in central Iowa, and we had this very cold winter. As far as why one survived and one didn't, the others did not, plants are just like people. They're individuals. And for some reason, that one plant was more hardy, was stronger, it survived, the other ones did not. I guess I'd be inclined to maybe wait another week or two before declaring the other ones dead. But if they don't leaf out soon, they are in fact dead. And this will be an occasional occurrence with the Rosa Sharon in central Iowa, where if we have a really cold winter, we may lose them. So it's something that you should anticipate in the future.
All right. And a final question of the day. This is from Nadia in Ames. We planted a decorative pear tree over the winter. It seems to have died. It had some buds early on, but never developed any leaves in the spring. Mm-hmm. There are some shoots coming out near the ground, so it isn't 100% dead. Is there a way to save the tree, or should we start over?
Yeah, the buds on trees and woody shrubs, they actually form in late summer. And so they simply rest until spring, and then they break and grow. So they've been there since last year. When you start to see growth at the very base, that's a very bad sign because that typically means the upper portion of the tree is dead. The root system is still alive, and so it wants to survive as best it can. So the only option is to send up sprouts from the base.
Okay, so start again.
I would remove it just because it's not worth keeping.
All right. Richard, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Iowa State University Extension horticulturist Richard Giron, Donald Lewis, thank you.
Thank you, Charity, and get out this weekend and enjoy the periodical cicadas.
All right. Iowa State University Extension entomologist Donald Lewis. And we'll be back again next Friday with Hort Day. We were talking about gnats this hour. You're going to talk about gnats on river to river today at noon, right, Ben Kiefer?
Yes, I am, Charity. We'll learn how the gnat invasion has become big business for a company, a mom-and-pop company in Columbus Junction. We'll talk with the developer of Bug Soother. I bet you have some at home or in your car. Most
Both.
Of us do.
Right.
That's coming up at noon along with a lot of other things.
All right. Thanks a lot, Ben. I'm Charity Nebbe. This is Talk of Iowa.